The second case for oral argument this morning is Patrick Hall and others, appellants versus State of South Dakota Appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. Brian Blesser, an attorney from Boston, Massachusetts, and Mr. Jeffrey Hurd, an attorney from Rapid City. Mr. Blesser, I understand you'll be presenting this morning. All right. And for the State of South Dakota, we have Ms. Carla Engel from the Department of Transportation. Mr. Blesser, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, and obviously with my co-counsel, Jeff Hurd, we represent the landowner appellants in this case. In 2006, Your Honors, the decision was remanded back to the trial court that you opined on in your opinion. You expressed concern that there was an inadequate development of the record. We're now back before you 5 years later, still without a trial, because despite discovery having fully developed that factual record and secured from the state the acknowledgement that our property owner clients were the only property in the project to be specially benefited by the interchange, the Exit 66 interchange, the trial court disposed of the matter on statutory grounds only, saying that under no circumstances does a property owner, as a matter of law, have any right to compensation for the removal of an access to an interchange on a controlled access highway. The trial court did not address the questions that this court had asked it to address, whether the landowner's alleged injury was peculiar to their land and not of a kind suffered by the public generally. There's no mention of special benefit, which, of course, relates specifically to that issue. Whether that after closure of the exit, the landowner still had reasonable access, whether the access was materially impaired, and whether the state's action was arbitrary or unreasonable. And, of course, you also said in your opinion that the state's purpose was extremely important to whether, in fact, the action of the state using its police power was unreasonable or arbitrary.
But, you know, aren't we here today on a totally different issue? I mean, we're really kind of here on an issue that was tried to be raised last time, and we didn't decide it. That's the statutory question.
That was the question that you did not have before you adequately at the time it was before you, but you also asked the court to go back and develop the record, which in developing that record, we discovered facts that raised the very issues that relate to whether, in fact, this statute, which has never been interpreted in this court before or in this state, does deprive a property owner from ever having any rights of compensation when an access is removed. And here we have an unusual case where you have two signal issues. You have the special benefit, which, as the court has said in the Emory case, is the mere image, really, of special damages. And you have a purpose that has been well documented in the record that was not for highway purposes, but to simply get rid of a use that was deemed incompatible in the flight zone. So you have use of a police power and abuse of that police power to get rid of a property rather than to take it by eminent domain through normal proceedings. These two salient facts make this case very different from when it was before you, when we were here 5 years ago, because we didn't know about special benefit. We now do, from all the discovery we did, and we know that creates a very different situation here before the court. I would say as well, the fact that the special benefit was not even considered by the court below, despite multiple briefings on this, despite all the evidence in the record, we presented case law from sister jurisdictions, Minnesota, and also from North Dakota, North Dakota being the filler case, the Minnesota case, being the Johnson Brothers case, as well as from other courts, Arizona and Alaska, all of which have had the same fact pattern that we have here today, which is where you have an access that's provided on a controlled access highway, the benefit of that used to discount the compensation paid to the landowner, property actually taken from the landowner for that interchange, And then later on, the access is withdrawn, and these courts have found, on facts very similar to our case here, that that is a second injury, and in fact, the second injury is for which compensation is due.
How does that injury pass from the landowner at the time of the taking to your client?
Your Honor, the special benefit, as has been well documented again in the briefing, Nichols on eminent domain in the case law, runs with the land. So successors in interest, property to prior owners of property, that special benefit still inures to the land. It doesn't run with the particular purchaser of that land or the owner of the land at the time. It runs with the land. So that is the basis upon which that special benefit continues. And when the court, when the state subsequently, 40 years later, never anticipated this to be taken away, does take it away, these courts that in cases that I've just cited have found this to be a second injury, a second taking, and have found compensation is due. And these are unique cases, and these are special benefit cases. We're not talking about a situation where we're trying to have a rule that would all of a sudden open up the entire interchange to takings cases, because there was no special benefit acknowledged in this case except in the one case of our own property owners. There are 40 properties. This is the only one that was specially benefited. And then the state takes it away, and you have a case of a second injury.
I answered
your question, Your Honor.
What about the, on that same line, though, what about the deed and the option agreement that has very strong language in it, suggesting that those rights were given up?
Well, the deed, Your Honor, I think we've addressed that over and over again. The deed was a form deed, and it says no access, and correctly so, because a controlled access highway means you do not have a right of direct access. In the brief that the state put in before the court here, they cited to Nichols, and then when you look at the cases involving the deed issue here, the McDonald case in that, which we address in our reply brief, clearly talks about the meaning in the deed means direct access. It doesn't mean indirect access. It simply means, of course, you have no right of direct access on a controlled access highway. That's the purpose of a controlled access highway. No one disputes that. But when you do, as 3186 does provide a designated point of indirect access, that's a very different animal. And, in fact, that's what the statute allows for. In fact, the designated point of access, when you use that designated point as a basis for special benefit and take it away, that, in fact, leads to that second injury or second taking. Now, in terms of the option agreement, I think all of our research and what we put forth, again, through discovery demonstrated that the option agreement was the controlling document, not the deed. And in that option agreement, there are two paragraphs. But as we read the paragraphs together, the state emphasizes one, we look at the other as well and say, we waive damages only with respect to the construction of that interchange. In other words, we did not waive damages and any rights to damages for the taking away of that. And if we look at what's in the record, the state's own attorneys have said they recognize that there would be potential for subsequent damages in a situation where there was nothing anticipated at the time that there would have been the loss of that special benefit or feature that was provided at the time of the construction of the improvement. So the point is nothing was anticipated. No one anticipated that this exit would be taken away. It was, and the fact of the matter is that it was a basis on which the special benefit and the reduction in compensation was based. And the case law that is very, very sparse but nevertheless clear and is consistent with this court's jurisprudence on special damages and the state constitution makes it very clear that that is compensable.
Now, Lesser, based on the state constitution, if this were the same case and there was not a special benefit issue, could there still be a taking in this type of a fact situation where it wasn't, there was a taking based on the police power, not in eminent domain?
Your Honor, I think there can be. We've also alleged other bases for this. When the police power let me step back a minute. The exercise of the police power can be for a valid public purpose. No one's disputing the exercise of police power and the public purpose involved with whatever it be in terms of preserving, let's say, Ellsworth Air Force Base. That's a public purpose, but it's not a highway-related purpose. And when you have the exercise of the police power, the real question is, and we see this in regulatory takings all the time, does the police power at times work in such a way, either because it is an abuse of the police power or it goes too far, result in a taking? Here we have, as again under state law, an easement that was acquired by the state, not in fee, easement for highway purposes. They use their police power relating to a different purpose, to preserve Ellsworth Air Force Base and to get rid of an incompatible use, which we have argued is outside the scope of that easement. When you impose a new servitude effectively on an easement that was only for highway purposes, then in fact you do have, again, a taking for which there's compensation. The other theory on which we have argued, which is the Supreme Court's decision in Lingle, the U.S. Supreme Court, that what the state has done in this case is what we call the functional equivalent of a regulatory taking. What they did was take a lawful, non-nuisance, legally established business and put it out of business through police power action. The case law here, the Marion case, the Lamar case, makes it pretty clear that you have a vested interest in your business that's lawfully established under the zoning. But in effect, they used the police power to simply get rid of the business.
Well, it wasn't a direct regulation against the business. They simply abandoned the road.
But that's what they mean by that's what the U.S. Supreme Court meant and Justice O'Connor meant when she said the functional equivalent of a classic taking. When you use police power indirectly to effectively get rid of something and take property without paying for it.
So an abandonment of the road is an exercise of the police power.
Well, that abandonment of the road, exercise of the police power, but then you have to look at what was the purpose of that police power. And in this instance, had nothing to do with highway purposes. There's no safety issue here for highway purposes. They really wanted to do only one thing, get rid of the Flying J enterprise and not have to pay for it. So they moved the exit down by 1 mile and sucked the oxygen right out of the business.
If we agree with your argument, what would be the measure of damages on remand?
The measure of damages, Your Honor, would be what the value of that property was before the exit was taken it away, and what the value, not of the business, but of the property, and the value after that exit was taken away.
It's pretty straightforward. It's purely a valuation of land. There's no claim for lost income or profits and that type of thing.
Well, if we go back to trial, we'll have an issue on damages, obviously, and we'll have appraisers trying to address that issue. It's possible that the loss of obviously the business and what that was valued as will be part of the equation. But the real issue is what's the property value before and after the exit was taken. It's pretty straightforward in that regard. But I do think it's important to emphasize that this is a very unique case. This is not something that's going to open up the entire swath of properties along I-90 for takings cases. This is the only property specially benefited, the only property where, in fact,
you say the only property specially benefited. I assume you're talking about in that area, the Ellsworth Air Force Base area. You're not. You don't know, or do you know, whether the entire length of the interstate in South Dakota also had instances like, for example, in Sioux Falls by the Empire Mall, mm-hmm. or in Mitchell and so forth.
No, I can't say I know that. I do know this involved 40 properties over 5 miles, and the state acknowledged, it's in the tabs in our appendices, tabs 2 and 3, that they acknowledged that that was the only property specially benefited. Well, how many situations, not only do you have a combination of special benefit, which is a limited situation, and the state can answer how many properties are specially benefited, and they've never made an allegation that there are special benefits all along the highway. But nor do you have a situation such as we have here where you have a purpose of the police power used to get rid of a business that nothing to do.
I mean, your reassurances that this is unique, it's only unique next to Ellsworth Air Force Base. I mean, potentially we could be opening this up to a change in traffic pattern in Sioux Falls or Mitchell or Chamberlain. With similar types of agreements, could be opening up all those issues, too. We just don't know.
Well, I don't think we do, Your Honor. I think the other analogy I want to point to, which is already a policy of the state, is in Section 31.1923, which involves the quick take statute, which does say that when, in fact, a feature, an access or some other feature of a public improvement is used again and relied upon by the person whose property is taken for compensation and then later taken away, compensation is due. And all we're suggesting here is that your own constitution and the special damages part of the damages section, which has been deemed to recognize the consequential damages of actions that are short of an absolute taking, do result in the right to compensation. So the policy is already there, and what we're saying here is you have a unique set of circumstances. You don't have an Ellsworth Air Force Base situation and all the way down I-90. You have one area where they understandably wanted to get rid of uses, and they chose the indirect way of doing so, and by doing so, they abused that police power, and it took away a benefit that was bargained for, and in fact, compensation was reduced for. And I think the case law, as sparse as it is very clear that when you have a special benefit such as this and it's been taken away, you do have the right to compensation because it's a second taking. It is not the first taking. It's the situation where the special benefit has been recognized, relied upon, and when it's taken away subsequently, compensation is due. And I don't think you'll find that this opens up the door at all, because we are talking about a very unique set of circumstances, not just special benefit, but also a unique situation documented by these studies as to what the state was about, what its purpose was in removing that exit.
Let's just to take away the part of the equation here. You're alleging that the state had an ulterior purpose, had nothing to do with traffic flow. It had to do with preserving Ellsworth Air Force.
They've acknowledged that, Your Honor.
But wouldn't your theory still work, even if the only reason for closing that interchange was for traffic reasons? Your client would still have a property now that was less valuable. Wouldn't he still have the same argument because he's got this special purpose provision?
He would still have the special benefit argument. I don't dispute that. But I think the real issue is how many situations is there? Do you have how many interchanges and how many special benefits do you really have along I-90 in South Dakota?
We don't
have that many.
We don't know. We really don't know except for the 40 properties that you've looked at, right?
Again, I would suggest this is all the more reason why we need to go back down and have a factual trial on this issue instead of constantly dealing only with the statute in the abstract. Let's have that trial and determine the issues of disputed fact and find out to what extent it's driven by just those facts. But this has been the problem. We've had a trial court that refused to look at all the information regarding special benefit, regarding the purpose of the state in doing what it did, regarding the material impairment of the access itself. We have evidence in the record from our expert, Mr. Shardlow, never responded to by the state, that makes it very clear that the removal of that exit, making exit 67 then the closest one to the property, made that property useless as far as the business for which it was developed. And so we have nothing in the decision of the trial court that allows us to move forward except to say we have some principles, though, and that they've been derived from the facts that we've been able to develop through the record so far, that need to be tried. And we have disputed questions of fact. We now have the state saying that what they really did was for national defense reasons. Well, if we have a dispute over the purpose of what they were doing, we have another issue of disputed fact.
But that would be irrelevant, wouldn't it, though? I mean, whatever reason they had would be irrelevant if your client has a special benefit and that was second taking.
Well, I'm not sure it's irrelevant, Your Honor. I think, as you have said, that the purpose for which the state acts in doing what it did, we're not saying that exit has to be there in perpetuity. The issue is when you take it away, what are the circumstances under which compensation may be due? If we did not have special benefit and they took it away for reasons that related, unrelated to the police power purpose for which the highway purposes are normally it's used for, we still would have a takings claim. It doesn't, whether we'd prevail or not, I can't tell you. Special benefit makes it very unique and very different. But when the state acts outside the easement for which it has, when the state abuses the police power, when the state materially impairs an access, all of these facts go to, as we've said with the Penn Central case, it's a fact-sensitive case as to whether a taking has occurred.
But what facts? I don't see any facts. Disputed fact under your special benefit theory. Setting aside the purpose, I mean, even the purpose is undisputed here.
Well, if I may...
What facts need to be resolved to decide this on your special benefit theory?
I would suggest there, again, based also on the court's opinion in 2006, the court had said the state's purpose in closing Exit 66 is material in determining whether the state's exercise of the police power was unreasonable and arbitrary. We have a dispute over what that purpose was, and the state has now joined that in its brief before the court, saying that the purpose, what we thought was in the documents, the studies that have been done, now they say this was for national defense. This was done if we had not removed the Exit 66 for some reason, we would have had a national defense problem with Ellsworth Air Force Base. A distortion of the record, but a dispute. If they consider this seriously, we have a dispute of material fact. The meaning of the term access under the deed is disputed. They believe that it means no access ever under any circumstances. We review that deed as meaning only direct access, very typical of a form deed. Third would be whether the deed contained the entire terms of the state's acquisition of the right-of-way, or is it the option agreement? That's a material fact of dispute as well. Also, whether the access was materially impaired. I mean, they, by virtue of us having provided proffered evidence of an expert on this issue, the state having not replied to that at all, at least we have facts in issue, which presumably they dispute. But it certainly deserves a trial on the facts. Our problem is that we've not, despite all that we've done with the trial court to really fulfill that record and give the factual development that you asked for. I mean, we went back to the South Dakota archives to find out about special benefit.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You might have the record for the longest answer to a question at the last minute. Okay. Ms. Engel, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have the privilege of representing the state of South Dakota in this case. May it please the court and counsel. Landowners have a daunting task in this case because the interchange was open to all members of the public. Everyone enjoyed its use. And in order to be able to recover in this case, landowners have to show special damage. And the special damages rule requires that a plaintiff show consequential injury that is peculiar to their land and not of a kind suffered by the public as a whole. The injury to the plaintiff must be different in kind and not merely in degree from that experienced by the general public. The landowner here makes a mistake that other litigants in inverse condemnation have made. The landowner argues that, well, I've experienced a substantial amount of damage, therefore I must have an injury. But the term injury refers to the infringement of a legal right, not the loss that flows from the infringement of that legal right. In Hyde versus Minnesota Railroad, this court wrote, one thing that has often led to confusion is in not distinguishing clearly between injury and damage, and in the careless use of the one term where the other should have been used. A person cannot be injured unless he has been wronged, and he cannot be wronged unless some right is infringed. Legal damage is the loss or detriment caused by the injury, the wrong, the infringement of some right vested in one. Moreover, one is not wronged, though he may have suffered damages, unless he has suffered the infringement of some right vested in him, which right is superior to the right vested in the party causing the damage. And so as you indicated, Justice Zinner, the question here really is, what right has been infringed? And because all of the public had access to that interchange, landowners employ two clever arguments to try to suggest to the court that they still had some special rights. First, they point to not the deed, which is clear and unambiguous. It says no access. Instead, they go behind the deed, even though there's no ambiguity, and they ask this court to look at the option agreement. But at every location in the option agreement, there is never any promise that the state is going to provide that interchange in perpetuity. In fact, as you pointed out, Justice Zinner, there is the opposite. Landowner relinquished, quote, all rights of access, air, light, and view to which he might otherwise be entitled between Interstate 90 and his abutting property. But the second method that landowners use to try to assert that they have a property right is to argue that because a special benefit was found some 50 years ago in determining the compensation owed to their predecessor, they must have retained some sort of property right. Well, there are a number of flaws with that argument. First and foremost is understanding what a controlled access facility is. And a controlled access facility has been defined by AMJER, 39 AMJER 2nd, Highway, Streets, and Bridges, Section 206 as follows. There are no abutters' rights to a limited access highway except those specifically granted. The owner of land has no right to a continuation of the flow of traffic in front of his property from an access-controlled thoroughfare, and the state may abandon, reroute, or otherwise divert traffic without any liability to an owner of abutting lands.
Does Andrew trump our decision in Hurley?
In Hurley, you had a landowner who was abutting a conventional street. So clearly, under South Dakota law, he already had a right of reasonable access. And in Hurley, the state then came along and sought to convert that conventional street into a controlled access highway. So there was no question in Hurley that the landowner already had a property right which the state was seeking to impair. And frankly, the North Dakota and Minnesota cases that the landowner continually urges upon this court are just like Hurley. They are cases where landowners abutted a conventional street, and the state then sought to convert those conventional streets into controlled access highways.
But wasn't there a problem here? Isn't there? It's a different reason, though. They were actually, the state's moving this for the purposes of getting rid of this business. Isn't that entirely different? Different than what you're talking about.
Well, you don't get to the issue of the government's motivation until you show a property right. And there is South Dakota case law that stands for that proposition, as well as federal court case law, which I've cited to the court previously.
Well, what about the Constitution, though? Your statutes that you cite have to be within the Constitution that talk about a taking or damaging of property.
They do. I'm sorry.
That's what the context that you have to look at the statutes within.
Yes, but taking or damaging requires the infringement of a right. And so before you even get to what the government's motivation was, for example,
their damages is to their property. Isn't that what we're talking about?
They have to have a damage that flows from the government's action. And what we did not affect their property whatsoever. The use of their property remained. The access to their property to the abutting street remained. The only thing that we changed was we removed an interchange that served a controlled access highway. And so they have to show that they had some property right to the connection that flowed from their property to that interchange.
Well, what about on that point, though, what about the special benefit as far as in the original taking, their severance damages were mitigated because of access at this location?
And thank you for asking that question, Your Honor, because I think it's very critical for this court to understand the difference between special damage and special benefit. Now, landowners say they're the mirror image. That's not true. The definition of special is the mirror image in the case of special benefits and special damage, meaning different in kind and not simply in degree. But the words that special is modifying are different. A special benefit is just that, a benefit that the landowner enjoys. And I can give the court several examples of special benefits in highway cases that confer no property right on the landowner. And that's what they're arguing, is that if you find a special benefit, there must be a property right that somehow got conveyed. But an example of a special benefit could be where the state comes through with a highway project and a landowner has hilly, craggy land. And as part of the project, we're going to be removing that dirt for use on our highway project. The landowner's bundle of sticks remains the same, or arguably becomes less, because we have taken the dirt. But they still have the right to use that property afterwards. But the value of the property may have increased substantially because now you may have property that's level and will allow commercial development or agricultural use, whereas it didn't before. Now, have we conferred any new property right on the landowner? Absolutely not. In fact, we may have actually taken part of their bundle of sticks. But they are enjoying a benefit, and they can go ahead and enjoy that benefit for as long as it exists.
Well, could you take that benefit away later without compensation? Could you pile something? Could you make the dirt pile big again because you wanted to? You couldn't do that without compensation.
No, but in that instance, Your Honor, we would be coming back onto the property and using the property itself. And in this case, we didn't disturb their property whatsoever. All we did was control the access to the controlled access facility consistently with the option agreement, which gave us all rights to control access between the controlled access facility and abutting lands.
But you know, the option agreement also says that it's subject to the construction, operation, and maintenance of a controlled access facility in accordance with the plans on file in the Office of the Department of Highways, which included, of course, Exit 66.
I would disagree with your characterization that the grant of right-of-way was subject to or conditioned upon the plans remaining as they were. And it requires a very, I would ask the court to look very carefully at paragraph 3. What paragraph 3 says is that grantor, quote, shall be released and discharged forever from all claims of damages, now or hereafter alleged, and then it goes on to say, by reason of the proper and legal construction, operation, and maintenance of said controlled access highway and facilities in accordance with the plans on file. That's a difference. Nowhere do we say we promise to keep the interchange as shown in the plans in exchange for your grant of property rights. Paragraph 3 is simply a relinquishment. We're relinquishing any damages, landowners relinquishing any damages as a result of any damages that might flow from the design shown on the plans. But then paragraph 5 goes on to say, beyond what's shown in the plans, the grantor relinquishes, quote, all of his rights of access, light, air, and view. And so actually the rights that the government acquired were broader than the rights that they exercised when they showed interchange. And I'd like to point out that one of the cases that landowners have relied on before this court actually supports the idea that the government can acquire broader rights than it may choose to exercise from one time to another. And the case that they cite the court to is Olson versus State of Arizona. And they cite it for the proposition that where the government promises to build something in accordance with the plans, the government is then required to pay compensation when it ceases to construct it in accordance with those plans. But the actual facts in that case and the actual holding of that case were different. In that case, the landowner came back and complained after he had provided right-of-way to the state. He came back and complained because the state later built a median through the roadway, which blocked traffic coming from one direction from entering or exiting his property. And so the landowner sought compensation for the construction of a median. And what the court in Olson said is that the state had acquired the right to manage that right-of-way, and that the fact that the median wasn't shown in the plans did not prevent the state from later building a median, because a median would be a non-compensable item of damage. Well, the same argument applies here. Landowners conveyed away all rights of access. The fact that the state built an interchange that happened to be in close proximity to landowners' property did not translate to a property right, because that had already been acquired from their predecessors. The other point that I'd really like to emphasize is that there was no street that existed when this project was built and when the rights to control access were first obtained. And so landowner didn't have any abutting street to which he could assert reasonable rights of access. So landowner's effort now to claim that they have a right of access when their predecessor never had one simply isn't supported by the overwhelming weight of authority that I cited on pages 14 through 17 of my brief. But I would like to get back to Justice Meyer Henry's question about motivation. And it's important for the court to recognize that motivation only comes into play once you have established a property right. In the case of Reicheldorfer, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case I cited, the United States Supreme Court court said, the existence of value alone does not generate interests protected by the Constitution against diminution by the government, however unreasonable its action may be. And then in Hyde, our court said, if a private right, as distinguished from a public right, is impaired, it is immaterial, so far as the question of private damage is concerned, whether the injury, if any, was inflicted under a rightful exercise of the power of eminent domain, thus eliminating the question of public nuisance, or whether the injury came through the wrongful act of the other party. Nor is it material whether the injury was inflicted to further a public purpose or to further a private purpose. And so you don't get to looking at whether the government's actions were reasonable or what their purpose was until you show a property right. And that idea is further supported by what this court wrote in the original Hall opinion. This court said, in each case, therefore, the relative rights of the public and private interests must be considered, and the reasonableness of the regulation and the degree of its interference with private property determined. Well, you don't determine the degree of interference with a private property right until you find the private property right. This court said in Darnell, no compensation will be allowed unless there has been an infringement of a private property right. That's the error of landowners' argument, is that no matter how you cut it, they can't show a private property right. And I would like to segue back again to the public benefits argument, because they argue vigorously that they have five cases that support the notion that a special benefit runs with the land. So if you find a special benefit, that benefit must continue for each successive landowner. Well, Nichols on eminent domain doesn't support that notion, because they specifically say all you need to show is a reasonable certainty that the benefit will materialize, not an absolute certainty. In addition, in the cases where a landowner never gets the benefit at all, the state would not quarrel that where the improvement is abandoned, it's never actually built, or where the special benefits don't materialize at all, that the landowner should have an opportunity to recover compensation as a result of that. We wouldn't dispute that, but that's not the case here. The interchange was in fact built. Landowners concede that everyone at the time expected that the interchange would be built and would be continued, but it never guaranteed that it would be there forever, and that's evidenced by the option agreement. But I also would like to point out that landowners, footnote 5 of their brief, they claim that the Correll case, the Alsop case, the Johnson Brothers case, and the Filler case, the North Dakota and Minnesota cases, that they all stand for this notion that special benefits run with the land. If the court reads all of those cases that landowner has cited, none of them discuss special benefit whatsoever. The Johnson Brothers case and the Filler case are about conventional highways that were converted into controlled access facilities. And ultimately, and what happened is originally the landowner had a direct right of access to their abutting street. Then the state came along and they created a frontage road. And the connection between the frontage road and the controlled access street still gave the landowner very close proximity to that controlled access street. So there wasn't much of a burden on the landowner, so there wasn't much damage. So the landowner was never paid for loss of access. Then later, the government comes back and removes that connection between the frontage road and the controlled access highway. And now the landowner has to travel over 1,000 feet in one direction or over 300 feet in another to get to the controlled access highway that they originally had a direct access point to. And what the court said in Johnson Brothers and in Filler is that the government can't take in stages and not pay for it. That if the government is going to take a property right, they ultimately have to be accountable for paying for it. Well, that makes complete sense. If you would have to pay compensation for the complete removal of a property right at the first time you build a project, you should ultimately have to pay compensation for the acquisition of that property right, even if you take it in stages. We don't quarrel with those holdings of the Johnson Brothers or the Filler courts. But those aren't the facts in this case. And that's the problem that landowners have to overcome. They have to cite this court to some authority that will support their position that because they sustained substantial damages, that somehow translates to a property right. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Engel. Counsel, you have 10 minutes, sir.
We've covered quite a bit of ground with the state's argument. I think one of the key points I want to make is that much of what she has argued begs the question. We are not arguing that this access needs to remain in perpetuity. We're arguing about the fact that the state conferred a special benefit, used it to mitigate and to make it clear. We're not talking about, in these cases such as Filler and Johnson Brothers, the term special benefit is not always used. It's not as if it's the only buzzword in these cases, but the term mitigation is used. And that's the same concept. It's just to say, we're not going to pay you the full value of your property because we think you've been benefited by the proximity you have to the public improvement that we're putting in place, the interchange. So let's be clear. These cases deal with the same issue, whether they use the term special benefit or not. The state has argued that, in fact, they have to confer a property right on us for us to have the rights for compensation. And I also want to be clear, we're not arguing that special benefit is a property right. It gives rise to a property right. When the state takes property, discounts what it's going to pay because it says we're giving you some special benefit because of a public improvement, and then later takes that away, that results in an injury and results in a property right that has been injured. But it is not the special benefit per se that we're arguing is the equivalent of a property right. That's not the way the case law reads, not what the treatises say. She asks that we try to go behind the deed and somehow misrepresent the no access language. The fact of the matter is the statute says that you have no right of direct access, and as I say, the McDonald case, for the first time we found a case that the state cites itself and interprets what one of these deeds means no direct access. No one disputes that. But when in fact it does designate a point of access and confers a special benefit to a property owner because of the proximity to that, and then takes it away, you don't have the simple, straightforward deed, no access scenario. I would argue, if you go back to Darnell and to and as well to the Hurley case, that our case is distinguishable from both of them for a number of reasons. One, there was no access provided in those cases. There was no special benefit. There was no right-of-way taken from the property owner, as it was in this case. And we don't have the very unusual circumstances we've all talked about of the purpose that the state had in exercising its police power. So unlike the trial court, which seemed to think it could only work with those two cases, I would suggest that these special facts don't fit Darnell, don't fit the Hurley case. They give you working principles, but they are not factually similar at all. There's also the issue that has been raised that these takings in stages kind of argument that state has argued is the way to understand Johnson Brothers. Johnson Brothers involved not taking by stages, but simply cutting off access to the property owner. Once that was done, and again, they had taken, just in our case, they had taken a sliver of property. This is well diagrammed in the appendix to our brief. They had taken a sliver of property to create the interchange that they needed. So again, this property owner was abutting as a result of the actions by the state. So you have a very similar situation, and it's one that I would urge the court to look at and look at the diagram of that case versus our case, and you'll see that in fact it's very much apropos to our situation. Another point I think that is important to point out is that we're not suggesting, and I would I guess dispute the analogy given that the state has of a special benefit not being the mere image of special damages. I frankly don't understand what the difference is. I think the court has said in the Emery case that your understanding and way of viewing special benefit necessarily flows from the way you have looked at special damages. The fact that the two terms special are the same somehow, I really don't understand the reasoning. The bottom line is your own case law has made it clear that the flip side of that of special benefit is special damages. So I think it's a little bit of wordplay and not real substance in what has been argued in that regard. The only last point I want to make again and try to emphasize is that the concern that the court may have that this opens up the whole right-of-way or issue of Long I-90 to all of these claims is just, I think, not one that you need concern yourselves with. You'll notice the state has not argued that they give special benefit all along the highway. This is a very unique situation. It's a unique situation with the purpose that the state had in getting rid of our landowners' property use. And I don't think that if on the narrow facts that you have here that you have any danger of opening up this into a general cause of action for property owners. The fact of the matter is the state gave a special benefit. It can't take that away without paying compensation for it. And I would ask the court to recognize that policy is already in its statute in 31-1923. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.